Good morning. Today's title is Robin Hood, the Christian Socialist, Luke 12, 13 through 21.
Want me to read that paragraph?
Doesn't matter.
Luke 13 to 21?
Yes.
Would you like King James, Modern Language, Living Bible, or Revised Standard?
Pick one.
Revised Standard. Okay, Luke 12, starting with 13. One of the multitude said to him, "Teacher, bid my brother divide the inheritance with me." But he said to him, "Man, who made me a judge or divider over you?" And he said to them, "Take heed and beware of all covetousness, for a man's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions." And he told them a parable, saying, "The land of a rich man brought forth plentifully. And he thought to himself, 'What shall I do? For I have nowhere to store my crops.' And he said, 'I will do this. I will pull down my barns and build larger ones. And there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I will say to my soul, soul, you have ample goods laid up for many years. Take your ease, eat, drink, be merry.' But God said to him, 'Fool, this night your soul is required of you, and the things you have prepared, whose will they be? So is he who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God.'"
Thank you, Jeannie. The interesting part that I heard there was that he was saving up material things for his soul. So, I think his idea was that it wasn't really quite the way it should be. I'm gonna use this magazine, it's called the Plow Magazine, it's a conservative magazine, to get some wisdom out of a couple articles that I'm gonna refer to. I'm not gonna read them, but I am gonna refer to it. And one of the stories that caught my eye in the beginning was, it says, "Beyond Capitalism." And that caught my eye, and then I started reading an article on Robin Hood, and we all know what Robin Hood was about. He robbed from the supposedly rich or the church and give back to the poor because they were heavily taxed, and no one got anything out of it. And so he was actually a very religious Catholic. He was said to have mass three times in the morning before he would go out and do his deeds. And I'm sure he didn't do them every day. But nevertheless, I kind of looked at him as a Christian socialist in some ways. He was going to give back to the poor in some ways. And I think that's where we are at in the world in which we live today. How do we take care of the people that need help? There seems to be two different ideas in the world today, in the present situation, political situation. We have capitalism and socialism. We seem to be competing one with the other. And these articles are food for thought. They're not really, they don't give an answer to the question as to which one is the better or the worse. They want to stand on the idea, what does the Bible actually say about capitalism or socialism? My personal opinion is that we need both. We need both in our situation today and where we're at. We need ways of taking care of our people, and we also need capitalism to generate capital. Entrepreneurship and free enterprise generates a lot of good things, our technology, but it needs, as I said, to take on ethics and morals. I've been saying that for a lot of years. Just because you can produce a lot of wealth and store it away for yourself doesn't make it right. Now, our barns are not necessarily grain as they were in Jesus' time, because that was considered to be wealth. If you had a lot of food, a lot of grain saved up for yourself, then you were doing quite well. You had a successful harvest, and it was more about feeding oneself and taking care of oneself rather than having all the trinkets that we have today. We have a lot of things, we have cell phones, we have various different things. And so it was our new barns may be our 401 or our investment in the stock market, in which we have piled up lots and lots of wealth, and we say, okay, we have a lot for ourselves, and therefore we can sit back and do nothing and live off of it. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with planning for the future, and neither does these articles. Although they do tend to lean towards a monastic type of life in which you give up everything. This is the extreme of where we are at today, is to give up everything and live out in the woods somewhere for pennies a day or whatever, which I think is really impossible anymore. I mean, where do you go where there is nobody, where you can't, where you can rely totally on yourself? And I don't think that's the answer either. I think the answer is somewhere in between. We should appreciate the wealth that we have. But the problem, the question is who gets to share in the wealth of this land? Who does it belong to? Who owns the creation? And why do some people get to have it and some people not? As I said, I think we need, every idea should come on the table. I think if we lean too much towards capitalism or too much towards socialism, it's like a two-legged stool. It's not going to stand. We need all the things working together. And it just seems like the extreme on both sides get a voice, but the middle don't for some reason. And there's massive rich and there's massive poor. You take the shootings in which it had just happened, I think it's a failure of a society. People are getting weapons that shouldn't have weapons. They are mentally challenged in one way or another, mentally unbalanced in some way. And plus, I think another thing that's happening is in this country is these people, as far as I know, these last two shooters were white people. And I listened to a thing coming over on NPR on the way over talking about the white people are trying to, don't like the idea of this country going towards a mix or a browning of the United States. And so the rising up, the white males seem to be rising up and to try to put a stop to that. Because the one guy going down to Texas was going down to shoot Mexicans. And so I've said, and my fear is that eventually it's going to come down to Muslims. And you watch and see, it's going to not good. And I don't think our political leaders are necessarily stopping some of this stuff either. So I think they're kind of helping on both sides, I think, are responsible in my idea. We need to tone down the rhetoric a little bit.
These people who want to kill everybody different from themselves, do they call themselves Christians?
Yeah, they see it as this country as God's nation and designed for white people. And yes, that's they consider that whole scenario as Christian.
I'm having trouble seeing killing as biblical and Christian.
Well, we have a history of Christians, so-called Christians, killing in the name of their God ever since.
Well, we have a history of killing, period.
Right. So to answer your question, yes, they see themselves as Christians. Saving God's country. Because they see us as a city on the hill who give light to the world. And yes.
So thou shalt not kill doesn't really have a part in that. That's Jewish anyway.
Well, the distinction that I've heard given is the difference between murder and kill. So if you're going with the intent in your heart to go out and murder someone, that's wrong. But if you're going out to do war, that's not considered murder. That's doing it under the guise of a, yes, Dan.
You mean that's what they think?
That's the reasoning that I hear. I see it all as murder.
Yeah.
Simple as that.
It isn't right, but they think it is.
Yeah. They justify it in various different ways. And this is within the Christian community. They justify war in that way. And so to get back to your answer, yes, they think themselves as Christian.
I think maybe it's human to try to justify what we want to do, even if it's
I mean, we're human beings. We're going to try to justify no matter what we do in some ways. We come up with reasoning to say it's okay. So I think that we should really take care of our people in a much better way. One of the articles that I'm going to refer to here in a second is that it says just that. I don't think withdrawing from society with a monastic life in which you are trying to live away from society or separate from society is really right either. I don't think that such as like I was raised a Mennonite, but we were not totally withdrawn from society. We participated in society. But there are societies and places around that groups of people, different organizations who want to move away, totally away from society. But that's, it's almost a really, you can't really. And the one article that I'm going to refer to eventually is entitled, "Is Christian Business an Oxymoron?" by John Rhodes. And the question becomes, how do you conduct a business within Christian principles? I hear this advertised on my satellite radio, tax services based on Christian principles. I find that to be an oxymoron. I don't understand how. You're going to pay taxes that are right or you're not. So what does that have to do with Christian principles? You're paying taxes based on Christian principles. I don't know. So how do you conduct a business in the business world? And the question of that article was that these people, they were Hitterites, and who are a branch off of the Mennonite or the Anabaptists, who had this workshop in which they came there and worked for nothing, and all the profit they made for parks and whatnot, like swings and all that kind of stuff. And they donated, they came in and worked for free, or only for what they needed. That was it. And all the profit that they made from selling this swing equipment or this playground equipment went for different projects to help people. So they only kept what they actually needed to take care of themselves. And that was it's an interesting way of looking at life. But still, you're separate from the world at large, and you're still using the world to make your profit and to benefit from it, or to whatever project you're going to want that money to go to, whether you give it away totally and you live a monastic life, you're still involved in the world. I always found that to be kind of difficult to really wrap my head around. I would rather see the church involved in the community, right out smack in the middle of the community, and not try to withdraw itself away from that idea. And another article that I want to use, "What Lies Beyond Capitalism" by David Bentley Hart. And there I want to say that what he brings up, the golden rule, and which this being a conservative magazine doesn't see socialism necessarily as a real good route to go, but nevertheless it says that they do have the golden rule right: do unto others as you would have them done to you. It is morally bound to strive for the same essentials of life for others that one desires for one's own family. And isn't that what the golden rule is about? What I want, I also want for other people at the same time. And so he went on to say about health care, decent housing, education, a living wage, and security in our old age. Isn't that what the golden rule is somewhat about? Isn't that how we should see that in our modern day world? We should take care of ourselves. And another tragedy that happened was the young lady in the Kennedy family who overdosed here this week, and she had bouts of depression. So even all amounts of money is not going to really stop things from happening, no matter what. Here again, I think we are not caring for the people in general. We tend to want to like relegate them off to the side, and they're just a burden to a society. And here again, it's two different ways of looking at things. But the article goes on to say that how much do we rely on the government? As a Christian church or a Christian faith, how much reliance do we have on government to help us to do. Can we compel the government to coerce the government into doing these things? Or who is the government? All of us are the government to some extent. So how much do we want government intruding and saying and taking care of anything? So is it left up to us in small groups to take care of everyone that needs help? Or do we rely on the government? We say we pay taxes, so the government should take care of some of these problems, the homeless people and whatnot. But the conservative side, the way I see it, doesn't want to do that. They see that as everybody should take care of their own, which is an extreme as far as I'm concerned. And we can't, Tertullian said that we can't compel people to be religious also. So we can't coerce people into doing things that they don't want to do. And this too creates a problem, as it says in this article. How do we go about moving from one, changing the paradigm in which we are in? We have to do it in some ways, and I'm not... The articles in here don't give the answer. I'm sure none of us here have a really good answer either. But we somehow have to redistribute the wealth of creation. Most of us here are more center or left-leaning. And in the end, we have to pay more taxes, and the rich have to not make as much, have to, again, bring it back around and to help the people in some way. I just don't think that the idea that amassing, as the scripture said, big barns or big revenues and we sit there and do what? I don't know. It's for all the people of the earth to use. And really, we cannot continue to consume the way we do. We're the biggest nation, big consuming nation as that there is. We consume. It's based on consumption. So how much, Dan?
I think they got a set of amount people can get as far as accumulating, and make them give it back to people through special tax, which they won't let go through the present.
Right.
In there, that if they had $100 million, they ought to make them pay at least $1 million back.
Well,
for taxes.
My recommendation was that you should establish a percentage of which a CEO or owner of a company can between his lowest paid employee and the amount in which the CEO can be paid.
That'd be a good idea.
Yeah. You set up some kind of ratio, and then, if the company is investing money, that's okay, but, $500 million to a medical insurance CEO is really just for a bonus is like, that gets to be a little bit ridiculous. I think that's where we're at. We're at the threshold of ridiculousness of what some of these people make. I mean, we're not talking what you and I have made and amassed in our life to save, so we live our days is really a drop in the bucket compared to what some of these people at the top have. We have no idea how much money. It's a mess. I think it's a mess. The example in the Bible is Acts 2:44-45. In the beginning of the Christian church, they all came together and they all shared everything that they all had. Now, I'm not sure that example which failed because somebody, two people, a husband and wife, sold a piece of property and brought the money the story goes in Acts, but they kept some back for themselves and the earth opened up and swallowed them up because they lied. I'm not sure why the church in the initial beginning all came together and in one place and shared and sold their items. Is it based on the fact that they thought that Jesus was going to return very soon, so they didn't accumulate or plan for the future? I don't know how much of that was based on that idea versus a lifestyle in which they were presenting in Acts. So the two things have to go hand in hand. Now, another question that I wrote down, do you think that Joseph, the the stepfather, in this case, which I believe, of Jesus. Do you think that he had all the latest tools? He was a carpenter. Jesus was a carpenter. Do you think that they had a monastic life and they went back and said, oh, no, we're not going to use the latest chisels or the whatnot. We're going to go back here and use these old things back here. He automatically, I'm sure, that he had the latest tools to make the latest things. There's nothing wrong with having the latest technology and to benefit from the latest technologies. I don't think, but everybody should benefit. I think everybody should benefit from it. And the industrial age started a lot of this. But still, everybody should benefit. I mean, we all know the early stages of the coal miners and what have you. Only a few people really benefited from it. And that, I think, is something that the United States has to get over. I think, is part of male whiteness. I attribute that to that. And Paul, who was a tent maker, do you think that he didn't have the latest tools in making tents or net? I think he meant nets or tents, one of the two. Do you think that he didn't have the latest tools? Sure he did. He wanted to make the best product that was available at the time. You had to have the same thing. And the same is true as us. Why can't we have the latest things? The problem is, I see everything is getting outpriced. I mean, who can afford to buy a new car or a new pickup? A new house and how is the younger generation going to manage all this stuff that they're going to be in debt? We have a nephew down in Texas, and he between his education and the financing of his house and all the kids, he's going to be in debt unless somebody pays it off all his life. It's going to take him all his life to pay off his debt, and in the hopes of where he lives at is going to he's going to accumulate enough to have a yes.
Probably gives as bad as over, and I think Japan, when you buy a house, they figure 4 or 5 generations
yeah.
pay for it.
Yeah.
Debt on and on.
Yeah. Yeah. But the problem is, if you buy all this stuff, a vehicle, whatever, it's not going to last generational things. I can see why our younger generation just throw their hands up in the air, because where can they go? What can they do? Can they say, okay, I don't want an education? Or I don't want a vehicle, I don't want a cell phone. I mean, how do you manage all this? It's really like in a vice somewhat. You can't pay for it, but yet you can't be without it. So.
Yes, and if their parents have a lot of debts when they leave this earth, they're responsible for them, the children. Yeah. I didn't realize that until just recently.
I didn't realize that either.
Oh, yeah. Have to pay off your parents' debts.
So now we're going to pass this on to the next generation?
Yeah.
The next generation? I mean,
how are kids responsible to pay off
their
parents' debts?
I have no idea why they are.
I can't say yes or no, because things change and what have you. I thought when if I died with debt, then it would be dead with me.
I thought so too.
Or,
I read someplace just recently.
That's like, once you become an adult, why should you be responsible for any of your relatives?
They're looking to collect their debt somehow. I mean, we
talk
are in
debt.
Talk
to a lawyer about that and see if.
I don't know if that's true. Because you could lose your house just because your parents couldn't pay the debt and they died. And now I'm responsible?
That same idea kind of goes with marriage, though. Yeah. My daughter married a fellow. Kids in pain, quite high in alimony, or whatever it is.
Right.
But once she married him, she had a real good job. She had turned over to the court how much she made, and they decided she could keep her husband so he could pay double what he was.
Yeah, well, that's marital property.
But I mean,
that's
she,
marital. I can see that.
She shouldn't be responsible for a man's debts before she married him.
Well, yeah, but he managed his debt as well.
See,
but nevertheless, look how indebtedness that we our young people are. I mean, that they are. That they don't. I mean, and is this what we should be doing?
It's scary.
Yeah.
Yes, the left talks about and free education and certain things and living wages and what have you. I I'm not saying that they're wrong. I mean, how are we going to handle these things? I think both sides need to come together and solve a problem. And that's what he's suggesting here, that coming together is what we should do. Do we let all this up to like small groups? So if we divide up in like a small group and say, okay, we're going to like say a church group or a community or what have you, do we collectively support certain people at the expense of other people? I mean, isn't everybody entitled to the wealth of this great earth?
Yeah, just like I know there's talk that people that can't pay off their student loans, that we should take that out. I don't think that's fair. Because what about the kids that couldn't afford the school to begin with, you know? So they didn't get the education, and now they're working. They got to pay off, you know, somebody else's student debt.
I don't understand who the we is paying off the...
Well, through taxes.
Taxpayers.
Yeah.
And
forgive them of their student loan debt. When you and I didn't have a chance to go because we didn't have the money to begin with, and now we have to pay, you know, pay for theirs.
How are people paying for other people's kids' student loans?
I know there's talk about doing that. I don't know, but I don't want to do that now.
I think a lot of people do pay their student loans back.
Yeah,
they're talking about forgiveness. Pay through tax dollars, which
it's just in the talks, but I don't think it's fair to do that, you know.
So then, how do we start leveling things back out the way they should be?
Start changing the government.
Yeah,
start
I think.
Taxing Amazon and all that real big, and you know.
So taxing the rich. We're going to do a Robin Hood thing.
Yes,
we're going to go up and we're going to tax and steal from the rich to
write all of that off, and you know, I don't think it's fair. And they're a monopoly. They take away from the little man, you know, starting his own business.
All I can say to that right now, at this moment, is life is not fair, I guess. I don't know. I don't pretend to have the answer to the situation. I really don't. And I don't think anybody really has the answer. I think one thing that would help if we would get a higher wage. If you want to generate more taxes, you got to get people. You got to give people more money.
So they can spend more money.
So you have to generate more taxes and the whole way around. And I think that would be a start. But this idea of which wages have peaked out or leveled off for the last 15 years or 20 years, and no one has really gotten a substantial raise, how do they expect anybody to spend any money? So somehow the wealth has to come back around again. And until that happens, we're stuck.
And they're not entry-level jobs anymore. Some people, adults, depend on them jobs.
There was a really good article, I'm not even going to get into it, about people who live under the radar and who may have drug addictions or, you know, maybe came out of that but yet don't have an education, and they work at McDonald's and what have you, these menial jobs, and survive under the radar, in which we don't even know what's going on in the inner cities. Even around here, there's probably people who work menial jobs who live off on their own and don't really, you know, participate in society. They're the undercurrent of our culture, to some speak.
But what are you trying to say?
That about a living wage. That they're living underneath. We have a whole society underneath what we perceive to be our great society, that are self-existing, but not really known to you know, the government or the world at large. We don't. The beggar on the street, the homeless person, or you know, the person living in housing, the homeless person, you know.
There's a big piece in the Williamsport paper this morning throughout California. It's in those big cities there, getting so that the homeless, they don't have no place to go at all.
Yeah.
And they're defecating or whatever you say on the streets.
Yeah.
And they're so bad they have to clean them up every day, and finally they put toilets like Ed's Heads or something on all the streets, and they had somebody take care of them every morning, so that had a place for all these homeless people to go to the bathroom.
Right. The undercurrent of society.
That's a fact. I mean, mean,
yeah, yeah. I remember years underneath the Williamsburg Bridge in New York City, there was this cardboard tent city. I mean, it was all made out of cardboard. I mean, people lived, lots and lots of people came in and lived in, homeless people lived in these cardboard underneath the bridge. And they came in one day, Giuliani came in, I think it was, he came in and cleaned it all out. And where these people went, who knows? You don't know. It's a bigger problem than what we think. We live up here in this little part of Pennsylvania, and even up here, there's problems, just not on a bigger scale.
Well, it's got, so if you don't have two people working, you can't make enough to keep family going. But it used to be you had mother at home. Now they can't do it.
So if it would allow the income to go up, then it would certainly help a lot. But, you know.
Big business says they can't afford $15 an hour.
Well, $15 an hour, let me tell you, is not, with a family, you're not gonna make it on $15 an hour. I think these problems are real, and I think these are problems that our children and their children are gonna face, and are facing now. But yet, you know, what do we do? You know, I don't know. I don't pretend to have the answer. I do want to close with another idea, another story, a more positive story. It was entitled The Bronx Aquarian. It was written by Susanna Black, and it was about a lady, a black woman, who wanted to grow some things in a little garden. And she wanted to try to help or give back. And so she had a little patch of grass in her backyard, and she wanted to grow four things. She wanted to grow collard greens, because that became a staple from her African-American community and culture. Eggplant, because it sounded funky and different. And peppers, because I like peppers. And she said, I wanted to grow tomatoes, because I hated tomatoes. And so she started out growing these four things in this little patch of land in her backyard. And she started, whatever she didn't need, she gave away. And her name was Washington. Her last name was Washington, Karen Washington. And she was a physical therapist, but she didn't know nothing about farming and whatnot. But yet she started out by growing these four things. And across the street, there was a vacant lot, which was nothing there, and nothing but garbage. People would throw their garbage in Bronx. If you've ever been down in New York City, any vacant lot is just full of garbage. And she went in there and cleaned that out and started growing a bunch of vegetables. And it became a community garden. So more people started working around, more people started contributing more. And she took a place that was full of, and she said she didn't know nothing about growing, so she went to the library and she read books, got books on growing, and she learned how to, and then turned this vacant lot into a producing garden. And somewhere around 1998, when Rudy Giuliani just tried to auction off a bunch of these little vacant lots in New York City for money to build whatever, and she started a community organization and got with churches and restaurants and whatnot to fight this idea. And she won. Mayor Giuliani could not sell the property. And they went on to develop a bigger and bigger community active force. And they, every year or every time there was an election, this community organizing along with her went to each politician and said, look, if you want to win, you need our vote. And if you don't protect our gardens, you're not going to get our vote. And so it continued on and on. And she started, went north a little bit to up towards Chester, New York. And she bought some more land. And there she started the Black Urban Growers, or BUGS, she calls it. And it still is producing today. And so here's a story that, and she eventually went back to her Catholic roots. And a priest helped her, and these community gardens are supposed to be still going on. Now, I have noticed when I go into New York City, like the rooftop, there's rooftop gardens, a lot of rooftop gardens in New York City, whether you believe it or not, they're growing things up there. And here's an individual who took one little small thing and made it a lot bigger and a lot bigger. And I think that's what we need to do. I think that's an example of community activism that can be done. Maybe not growing, maybe not, it's something. Meg takes care of the cats. I mean, she's making it look like it's a community thing now. It's going on to Mansfield. They're spending more money to take... You're an example of what can be done as a community. I think that's a really good example. There's many different
but
things that we as
community... starts with one highly motivated
yes.
person.
Yes.
Who works hard at it.
Yes.
Works hard at taking care of those animals.
So I think as individuals, we can... You know, we a voice of one is very important. Here's an example of a voice of important. Here's a person sitting here, a voice of one who makes a difference. And so I think this is an example of how we can change the world around us. And as she reflects, she's 65 years old, and she says, I want to be able to say at the end of my time that I have made a difference in someone's life and that God is proud of me. And I never take my life for granted, she said. And whatever I give, I share with people. We have one life to live. And with that, I will say amen.
Wondrous Creator, you provide for our strength and gladness through the privilege of human creativity and labor. You supply all that is needful to us. With grateful hearts, we offer you these signs of our work and the breath, the